It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're talking about your favorite spring produce. This warm week should bring out more spring veggies soon. We've got a chef and food writer with some recipes for us. Now, clutter is big business in the United States. There are services to help us clean up and get organized or deal with all of our possessions after we leave them behind. And it's big in pop culture. Shows like Tidying Up with Marie Kondo make the case for getting rid of things that don't spark joy. Shows like Hoarders look at clutter when it's taken to the extreme. But all of those shows deal with clutter that we already have. Today, we're listening back to a conversation with a guest who says we need to look at the causes of clutter and what leads us to get so many things in the first place. What's your experience with clutter? Have you found a way to cut down on all that stuff you have lying around? How did you decide what to keep and what to get rid of? You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. Her latest book is called Clutter, An Untidy History. She spoke with Rob Ferret earlier this year.
Well, you open the book with a story about your mother and going through her home and her stuff. Can you talk about what you went through and why that inspired you to seek out more of the history of clutter?
Sure. Well, like a lot of us, I found myself actually very suddenly in the position of having to clean out my mother's house after she had a mental and physical breakdown. She went from overnight living in her house that she'd been in for 50 years to not being able to be there at all. It just wasn't safe. So it felt to me as an only child to go in and try to make some sense of everything that she had. You know, I had to deal with her papers, her finances, all the medical care, but then I had this house full of stuff. And I was shocked and overwhelmed by how much stuff my mother had managed to accumulate in all that time. I knew she was not a minimalist, but I didn't realize, until I actually had to deal with everything in there, just how much she had. And that got me interested sort of as a survival mechanism trying to understand what was happening and how my mother, and as it turns out, so many other people, wound up in this really, really difficult situation.
And you dug back into history and you find we're not alone in the United States with clutter and having lots of stuff. But you kind of trace the history here in the U.S. back to Victorian England when we start to have a different relationship with being able to buy lots of stuff and wanting lots of things. What kind of things did you find out?
Oh, it was fascinating. I could have written multiple books on the Victorians alone. I was hoping I could find a starting point for clutter, like the historical moment when clutter was born. And I couldn't really trace the moment, but there was so much in the Victorian era that resonated for me as a 21st century American, the kind of love of things and the love of having nicely furnished houses and all the stuff we can buy and the message that we get to, you know, that we should be buying things, should be buying more. The Victorians would have been very familiar with all of that. When you look at the Industrial Revolution and, you know, the ability to make more things more quickly and ship them to people, with the rise of cities, with department stores, all these things kind of started to coalesce as I was reading and looking around for me in the Victorian era. And you think about the Crystal Palace, the famous huge glass showcase, basically, of the London Exhibition in 1851. That really became a touchstone for me for this modern phenomenon of clutter. And I really felt it was very, very much an important starting point for that.
I mentioned earlier the TV show Hoarders. There are others that look at, you know, when collecting stuff really goes to an extreme. A big point in your book, though, is those shows sometimes treat the hoarder as this sort of individual pathology. You kind of see it, correct me if I'm wrong, you see it as a symptom of a wider attitude toward consumerism and our desire to have and keep stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, personal choice and personal habits and sometimes mental challenges can really contribute to this problem. But, you know, from the minute we're born, we are steeped in this culture of buy, buy, buy. You think about if you've ever been to a baby shower or anything you do in modern life often it seems to involve the message that you should buy something. And that's what you should be doing as a good consumer and all of that. And it's very hard for individuals to escape the power of that message. as I said, it starts when we're kids, and we're surrounded by advertising and by big box stores, and now online, e-commerce, Amazon. It's so easy to buy, and as I saw with my mother, I think she got trapped in this web of consumerism, and once you're stuck in it, it can be very, very hard for people to get out of it just through force of individual will alone.
Talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's a lot of clutter in your life? What leads you to buy stuff, bring you into your home? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting rid of stuff? Do you know someone who you've seen it go pretty far with bordering on hoarding things? What changed? Was there something that made them change their ways? Call in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, you just mentioned sort of the emotional connection we have with things. And I'm not a hoarder. I kind of go back and forth. I just purged a bunch of kids' drawings from their little. And I go back and forth between, there's a smudge on this paper that a kid might have made. Got to keep it forever, to this ruthless paring down. But I get the emotional investment in a thing. There's a memory connected with why we have it in the first place that I can understand people being reluctant to let go of. Talk about the emotions at the center of this.
Oh, that's really at the heart of it. That is what makes it, I think, so hard for so many of us to get rid of things, because we do have personal connections. And, you know, if grandma gave you something, mm-hmm. or the little thing you brought back from the sea, you know, your beach trip with the kids, and you feel like you're throwing away the vacation if you throw away the object. It's really hard. And if every object or many of them have that kind of some kind of emotional baggage with them, no wonder it's hard to get rid of them. If you have to stop and process all those feelings, those memories, it's overwhelming. And it's easy, again, since we are a society that really does value things, we sometimes conflate the thing with the person or the memory, and it's very hard to kind of extricate yourself from that. The kids' artwork, everything your child ever touched is valuable, or feels like it, but it's hard to actually sort of get yourself to do the process of sorting and deciding what's really important, what's enough, and what's too much.
A lot of our efforts, and a lot, I think, businesses make money off of this, they go toward the back end. We have the clutter. We have the stuff. How do we organize it? How do we sort it? How do we purge it? Whatever. What kind of things are you thinking about when it comes to the front end, whether we bring a thing into our house in the first place and how we curate it before it becomes cluttered in the first place?
That's the thing. If you can head it off at the pass, that's the way to go. It's very hard because we're in a society that gives us freebies and sends, everything comes in a bag and a package, and you go to if you go on to a hotel, you come home with all these little shampoos and conditioners. You know, it's free. Why not? Maybe it'll be useful. And it's so, but you really have to take that early step of saying, do I really want this? Do I really need it? You know, is it just gonna take up space in my medicine cabinet or my closet or my kitchen cupboard? All those sauce packets that you get if you get takeout, takeout food. And when you start looking for opportunities to say no to things, you realize there are a lot of them, and it doesn't seem like it would make that much of a difference, but over time it really does. And it's, saves you time, saves you the energy of having to try to figure out what you're going to do with it down the road. Bigger purchases too. Do you really need more clothes? Shop your closet first. There are things you can do that really will help address the clutter problem and be more economical and also just better for the environment and society in general.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Wazaki. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am an artist. My husband sort of considers me a hoarder. I mean, he can get through my house and my dishes are clean, but I paint and I quilt and I draw and I sew and I have canning stuff I've got stuff. I've probably got 5-6 times what the average person has, but it's because I do all of these things. I have trouble finding homes for things, permanent places to put them, and I have difficulty with storage. But but I worry. I'm getting a little bit older, and I worry about something happening to me, and then what's whoever's left taking care of it going to do with all of it?
Have you thought, Lisa, or have you looked for ways to curate a purge? I know it might be hard, but deciding that some stuff has to go, even if it doesn't find a home?
Yes, I've actually pared down some of the things that I've done. Like, for instance, I can do probably 100 different crafts, but I've decided that, you know, maybe 5 of them are what I'm really interested in, and I've tried to let the rest of it go. But I have to bring myself back to that regularly, because my set point is to try to do everything.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Jennifer, that reminds me, this is that the thing where somebody we might look at and say is a hoarder, which we'll talk about that word in a bit, but also they might be an artist. There's a lot more to their story than that, as we just heard from Lisa.
Sure, absolutely. No, that really resonates with me. And, you know, if you're using your things and appreciating them, they're not really clutter, I don't think. I mean, clutter is chaotic, it's messy, it's kind of deprives the, it makes the things not really useful in the way they are. And it sounds like someone like Lisa, who's actively creating and using things, you know, maybe there's sort of a, she can sort of think of her excess as, there might be other people out there who could use things, or she could kind of help circulate things. I don't know. It's I think there are some ways to make it less, make the amount of stuff seem less overwhelming. And if you're thinking about it in the first place, that's huge. That is I think it really sets someone who can handle their stuff apart from people who are just lost entirely in all their stuff.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're talking to writer Jennifer Howard about her book Clutter: An Untidy History, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about clutter in your life, your relationship with your stuff, your kid's stuff, your parents' stuff, maybe, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with writer and editor Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Marcus on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. So my great aunt and uncle used to have a little wooden plaque in their house that said, creative clutter is far superior to idle neatness, and I completely agree. As for like what the guest was talking about before with, or you were saying with kids' pictures and stuff from the beach and whatever else, I like to do art in my free time. And so I started taking with my kids, we'll sit down and go through their pictures from school and whatever else. And then some of the stuff we may have picked up, rocks or shells or whatever at the beach. And then we try to either get a board or a shoebox or something, make some sort of diorama or some sort of other creation out of pictures that they pick. So that way they're having to kind of choose and go through, like, why they like this one or why I like this one. And then we kind of create something new. So then you add an extra layer of memory on top of it. And it's a great way to use up some of that stuff.
Interesting, Marcus. Thanks so much. What it's kind of shopping at home, Jennifer, and creatively repurposing the stuff that's around instead of just, I guess, storing it somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. I mean, that really shows you that objects can have a meaningful role in your life, and, you know, there's an active choice there too. And it gets, I love that Marcus is getting his children to think too about what matters to them and what their, you know, how they can kind of work their important things into their lives instead of just having stuff pile up around them and not be appreciated. I think that's great.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that. Could have used that probably 15 years ago. We'll go next to Jamie in Middleton. Jamie, hi.
Hi, this is Jamie. I was just speaking to, my parents are moving out of the house we grew up in, and so they've been there for 30 years, and their professions are a former art teacher and construction worker, and so with those careers come a lot of stuff. So we're finding it tough to get rid of and want to be mindful of how to recycle and not waste, but 30 years can be quite the accumulation.
Yeah. And now, Jamie, is there a sense that, hey, some of this stuff, I mean, construction worker, art teacher, they're going to have stuff that might be useful to somebody? Is that part of the stumbling block that they want to make sure they're not wasting something that somebody can make use of?
Yes. And obviously, it's a passion of both of theirs. And a lot of heart goes into the work. So you know what things are worth and all the different ideas you have with it. So yeah, definitely want to recycle and reuse and give it to someone else who might find use, but quite the process. If it's not something you kind of keep up with, then and sort through as you go.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing that. This is something, Jennifer, that a lot of people have been through. You, to some extent, with your mom's stuff, like, some of this is going to end up in landfill, but maybe some of this has sentimental value for somebody. Waste not, want not. Maybe somebody could use this stuff. How much could that lead to keeping the clutter?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. People think, well, it's, you know, it's perfectly good. I don't want to throw it out, you know, and it, the old, it could be useful someday. And the truth is, most of the time, it's not going to be useful. And if you really need that thing, you can probably borrow it or get it again. But I, you know, the idea is much easier to let go of things if you can rehome them and you know that you're going to, that they're going to be used. They're not going to wind up in a landfill, especially when, as Lisa was describing, there are things that, you know, have to do with how you spend a lot of your life, your career, your family. And it takes a lot of work to do that kind of the rehoming and donating. But if, especially living at a family house and try to get your, help your parents deal with all of their things, it probably is worth the time if you can take the time, even though it is harder. You don't want to just pull up a dumpster and, you know, throw it all away. It's much easier to try to, ultimately, it's more emotionally satisfying to let it go when you know it's going to have another life.
Thanks again for that call. Good luck to your parents as they make those decisions. We are talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Kewaskum. Dave, hi.
Hey, yeah, so like that caller Lisa before, my dad was an artist growing up, so he always collected a bunch of what people call junk, you know, plastic tubes, stuff like that. And they always sort of rode that line of being hoarders. And then one day, between health issues and they got hold of that Marie Kondo book, they just went through and threw out everything. And they were very satisfied. They're very happy with where they are right now. But in the process, they threw out a lot of, you know, family heirlooms and stuff that was significant to the family. And we never really got an opportunity to go through it with them and point out what we would like to keep. And that sort of left an open wound in the family.
Wow. Dave, thanks for sharing that. I mean, did you come to terms with that? Did you talk to them about that, find out other ways to keep memories without the object?
Not really. I mean, we managed to salvage some family photos, but that's still sort of an ongoing thing.
Wow. Dave, thank you for sharing that. Jennifer, maybe this is another extreme. I don't know. Some people did want the stuff that was gotten rid of here.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a balance, you know. I think, especially when you're, it's not just your stuff, but it's your family history, which especially with a family house, you know, and your parents have. I just went through all my elementary school papers that my parents had saved, and you know, at least I got to make the decisions about that and got to relive some of the highs and lows of my, you know, my childhood. And I regret, one thing I really regret with my mother is that I didn't have a chance to sit down and hear her stories about her stuff. You know, I was flying in the dark, basically, when it came to what was important to her, or who this person in this photograph was. And it's a loss, you know, as the caller was just describing, it's almost like everything got taken away from you in a fire or a flood. You know, to have no say in how your history, what parts of your history you get to save, that's really traumatic. And ideally, if you have relatives who are downsizing, they will give you a chance to, you know, hear their stories and help you, or you maybe get, let you help them make some choices about what to save and what might be meaningful to future generations. Because once that stuff is gone, it's gone.
Thanks, Dave, for sharing that with us. Sherry joins us now in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi. My husband and I taught internationally for 32 years. And we traveled, and everywhere we went, we'd collect things. And then we'd come home, and we'd store them away. And then we'd go to another location. And so now that we've retired, we've unpacked all this stuff. And we have a very cluttered house with stuff, beer steins, paintings from China, paper cuts, teapots, Saudi Arabian coffee pots, porcelain, and beer steins, and it goes on and on and on. And I'm trying to, and our children aren't interested, and so I'm trying to figure out where I could have these things settled, because it's not like something you would get at a thrift store, I don't think. Of course, my treasures. So I would love to know where I could actually take some of the stuff, because some of it is antiquities.
Sherry, thanks for the call. And this has got to be a common question. I bet a lot of people bring it up to you, Jennifer. This stuff is too good to just give away, but I don't know what to do with it.
Oh, it's so common, especially as with a lot of family furniture and things like that. And it sounds like the caller has a lot of interesting stuff collected from around the world. Honestly, it's good to be realistic about whether people really want to pay money for your things if you don't have family members who want them. A lot of people do have success with estate sales, and you don't have to die to have an estate sale. You can have a downsizing sale, and there are companies that will actually work with you, and they do take a percentage of the profits, but they can come in and they kind of look at what you have and put prices on it and advertise the sale. That could be potentially a useful option in that case. But sometimes you just have to let it go too, and to know when it's too much effort to try to sell it, and it's better to just find it a new home.
Well, thanks for all of your calls today. And Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. And I loved all the calls. So many good stories.
That was Jennifer Howard, a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. She spoke with Rob Ferret earlier this year about her latest book called Clutter, An Untidy History. And if you have an experience to share about decluttering your own space or helping a loved one cut down on clutter, you can let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, asparagus. Is yours up yet? We want to hear about it. We've got recipes for radishes and more in this week's edition of Food Friday. You can get us started right now at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite spring produce? Have you made it to your local farmer's market yet? What do you love to make? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the extension of Michael Gabelman's Republican-backed investigation into the 2020 election here in Wisconsin, and we'll hear a political scientist's argument about why it should be ended. But now, farmers markets are starting back up for the season. Some produce you might see as you walk around, turnips, radishes, greens. Maybe you've got those veggies grown in your own garden. Our next guest tells us how to make the best of spring's bounty. And you can join our conversation here at 800-642-1234. Are you excited to get back to your local farmer's market? What produce is your favorite? What are you looking forward to? What questions do you have about cooking with rhubarb? 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. With us now is Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer. He's the author of a cookbook called The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Hi, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm so glad you could join us. Now, I just have to ask, because we are having the slowest spring here in Wisconsin, except for this week, which has been crazy hot.
Yeah.
What's the spring been like for you so far?
I'm here in eastern Pennsylvania. It's been pretty much the same. We had cold, cold, cold weather, cold nights, so we couldn't get anything in the field. And then all of a sudden, it was like 80 degrees this week. It's been a little wonky, but we're headed to summer eventually.
Yeah, so a lot of the traditional spring produce that you might expect to see at your first farmers markets feels like it's a little behind.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, the stuff that we have a farmers market tomorrow, and the stuff that we're going to be bringing has been grown in high tunnels and greenhouses, just to make sure that we have stuff for the start of the market for this season.
Yeah. So what makes you most excited for spring? What comes to mind? What is it?
As far as food goes?
Yeah, pick a favorite.
Oh man. I mean, I love spring veggies because they've just been so, it's just been such a long winter, you know? And so we eat what we grow, and we have a lot of storage crops, but that basically means that we're eating beets and potatoes and turnips, from like November until now. So like, anything that pops up in the spring, I get excited about. One of my favorite things, and it's an early riser, is watercress. Yeah. I love watercress that grows in a stream. It tastes totally different than stuff that you can grow even hydroponically, which never made any sense to me. I don't know why that's the case, but it's so true. You know, wild watercress is just like the sharpest bite. It wakes you up. It gets you ready for the season. I love it raw. But I also love to cook with it. In fact, it makes one of my favorite sort of like creamed spinach dishes. I like to use watercress instead of spinach. I thicken it with a potato. So I boil a potato and then I add the watercress to the pot at the very last minute, drain everything, and then puree it with a little heavy cream. So it's super simple and it's got so much more flavor than creamed spinach. So it's a really great side for a steak or a grilled piece of chicken.
That sounds great. So how do you recommend folks find it if they don't happen to live in a place where they've got a stream next door?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so I've actually been experimenting planting it. So you can order watercress seed from any seed company, and they're little tiny, teeny, tiny seeds. And I found a stream near our house, and I went and I tried sowing the seed in the stream. And it didn't work because we got a heavy rain, it all got washed away. So what I did this year, which has been successful, is I started the watercress seed in flats in our greenhouse. And I just kept it really soaked until it had established a little bit of a root system. And then I transplanted it into the stream and it totally took.
Wow.
It's thriving. And so probably by next season, I'll be able to harvest enough to eat. So that's been a fun experiment.
And I got to ask about asparagus. You have it yet?
Yeah, we do. We're about halfway through our asparagus season. What do you want to know about asparagus? Asparagus is one of my favorite things.
I wanted to know how you cook it because I feel like people have very strong feelings about this. What is your favorite way?
All right. So if you go to France and it's asparagus season, you go to a fancy restaurant. You can order a side of asparagus and it costs like 30 euros and it's worth every penny. Because here's what they do. They go outside, they cut it, and they cook it and then they serve it. The longer the asparagus is, sits between the harvest and the plate, the less flavor it has, the less texture it has. And so like, it's one of those things, like if you have an opportunity to cut it or you live near a farm that grows asparagus, ask them when they're going to harvest it and then show up that day. So here's what I do. Here's my favorite way to cook asparagus. I like to peel, it's old school, but I like to peel the bottom end of the asparagus with a vegetable peeler.
Okay.
And then I put the asparagus in a skillet of room temperature water and I add some salt to that. And when I'm ready to cook it, I turn on the heat and everything comes up together. The water and the asparagus come up in temperature together. What the reason is because then you get a really even cook. If you drop your asparagus into boiling water, what you get is sort of mush on the outside and not quite cooked on the inside. And
yep.
Sometimes the tip starts to fall apart because the tip is a little more tender. But if you bring everything up together, then you get this totally even cook. It, depending on the thickness of the asparagus, it's going to take between 4 minutes and 7 minutes. And then I like to take it out just a minute before it's totally tender because it keeps cooking. If I'm going to serve it hot, if I'm going to serve it cold, which I also love, I will take it out exactly when I'm happy with the texture and then I'll throw it into some ice water to stop it from cooking. So that's my favorite way to cook it because you have so much control over it and you really, let's talk about that peeling again. The reason like I like it peeled is because the bottom end is always thicker. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you take the skin off the bottom end, then the top end and the bottom end cook at the same time. So you don't get mush on top and hard on bottom. You get totally even cooking.
I gotcha. And then what do you put on your asparagus, if anything?
One of my favorite things is a mustard vinaigrette with some capers in it, some olive oil, some lemon juice. Or you could use like a tarragon infused vinegar would be nice. And then the finishing touch is I take a hard boiled egg and I force it through a mesh sieve so that it becomes what's called a mimosa. And it's sort of like, you know, is confetti over top of the whole dish.
Nice. Nice. We got a comment from a listener. James wrote to us on Facebook, and James says he loves creamed asparagus on toast with some pink Himalayan sea salt or Himalayan salt, black pepper, and topped with some Parmigiano Reggiano. It's
that
a real treat.
Delicious. Yeah, I mean, creamed any vegetable is right up my alley. And I also like how simple it is, you know, because it's a good asparagus, like you don't have to do that much. So it sounds like James adds a little cream, a little salt and pepper, and of course the Parmesan, and like that, and that's where you need to stop, right?
Yep.
So don't mess it up.
And can you taste the difference between like foraged asparagus versus actually planted asparagus?
I don't know that I've ever eaten foraged asparagus. I've seen it on the side of the road in some places, but I never stopped to pick it because I always figured it was somebody else's.
fair enough. But that's definitely a big thing here.
Yeah, I would imagine that there would be a difference. I mean, anytime you have something wild versus something that's cultivated, you definitely get a difference in flavor. So I would imagine that there would be a difference.
And cutting versus snapping, do you have strong feelings?
I usually cut to harvest and then I snap.
Oh.
Yeah, all because right. Each spear has its own breaking point, you know, so they're all sort of unique in that way.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about radishes, because sure. I saw your recipe and it's something I had never considered, making a soup out of radishes.
And that soup is actually a cold soup, which is nice for weeks like this one when you have 80 degree days out of nowhere. And all you have are radishes because they're the first thing that pops up in the garden or on the farm. That soup's really fun because it uses buttermilk as its base. And so you get sort of the tang and the creaminess of the buttermilk. And it really helps balance the bite of the radish because the radishes in that recipe are raw.
Yeah.
And so everything gets blended together and you use really sort of refreshing cold soup. It's a really fun recipe. I make it every year.
And what do you recommend if buttermilk isn't a thing that people have in their kitchens? If they don't have it handy, what's your favorite trick?
So my favorite trick to fake buttermilk is to take, let's say, a quart of milk, because usually people have milk in their fridge, and a couple tablespoons of lemon juice, and mix that together. Just keep it cold. You don't have to heat it up. But if you mix together the lemon juice and the milk, what it does is the acid of the lemon juice actually starts to very slightly curdle the milk. So you get that sort of viscosity that you get with lemon juice, and you also get the tang. So that's an easy fake to make buttermilk if you don't have it in your fridge.
Yes, I love it. We're speaking with Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer. He's the author of The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. And he's with us today to share some tips and recipes on spring produce. We'd love to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Have you ever tried your hand at foraging? How's the mushrooms coming? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Ian Knauer. He's a chef and an author, and he's telling us the best ways to prepare spring produce. So, Ian, I am so curious about mushrooms and what you find where you are.
Sure. We have a lot of mushrooms here. Pennsylvania is a woodsy, damp place, and that's what they like.
Yeah.
This time of year, of course, we have the noble morel, which is one of my favorite mushrooms, yes. Not only to cook with, but to try and find.
They're
sneaky little buggers. They hide really well because they're brown, just like the leaves. And so you really have to like adjust your eyes to try and find them. You know, it's even sort of like baked into the language. You forage for mushrooms. You hunt for morels. And so like, right. there's so much more difficult and therefore so much more rewarding when you find some. And when it comes to cooking them, I like to keep it as simple as possible. Morels have just a beautiful woodsy, earthy flavor. And so all I do is I saute them in a little butter and then I sprinkle them with a little salt and that's it. And depending on how many I find, I'll either toss them with pasta or I have actually been out for hours and only found one. And so I'll come back and just saute it and put it on a little piece of toast and just eat that one mushroom.
Savor it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we had a listener that called in. Keith from Green Bay was wondering if the hot weather will hurt the morel season this year. What do you think?
Well, they had a long run of cooler weather, which is obviously what they like. And so they had an opportunity to get really established. The last week or so, since it's been getting warm, they're just going to kind of like bolt like cilantro does, and they'll just exponentially increase in size. So if you're going to go out, it's probably a good time to go out now, because then they turn into little Christmas trees at some point. Not that you can't eat them then, but they're just a little unwieldy.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to the phones now where we have Kathy joining us from Presque Isle. Hi, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Hi. Say, I have access to a lot of wild ramps, and I know that they can be used like an onion or garlic almost, but I'm wondering if your guest has a favorite recipe or two that he likes to use ramps.
I bet he does.
Hi, Kathy. Ramps are my favorite onion. I absolutely love them. I love them raw. I love them cooked. I love them in soup. Let's see. Okay, so let's just start with pizza. So if you're going to put ramps on your pizza, which I highly recommend, make a bechamel. So cook a tablespoon of butter in a tablespoon of flour, and then add a cup of milk. Bring that to a boil with a pinch of salt until it's thickened. That takes about 8 minutes. Use that as your sauce. So then you spread out your pizza dough. You spread your bechamel over that. And then you take the bottoms of the ramp. So like the bulb and the white or pink part, chop that up and sprinkle it on. Bake your pizza, and when it comes out of the oven, lay the leaves, the green part, on it, and they'll just sort of wilt as on the hot pizza. They don't need a whole lot of cooking because you want to preserve that sort of like really deep woods flavor that they have. So that's one example. Another thing to do is ramps and nettle, stinging nettle, pop up at the same time. So if you find some ramps and some nettle, cook an onion in some butter, and we're going to make a soup. Cook an onion in some butter, and then add some chicken stock. Bring that to a boil and throw your nettle tops and your ramps in there for like a minute. Puree everything. Add a little bit of cream if you want to. And then that is maybe the most delicious spring soup you can have. It also cures everything. So if you have a cold and you make that soup, like, it'll be gone. So those are two examples. Basically anything with ramps makes me really happy. Another quick tip on ramps. I could talk about ramps for hours.
do you ever pickle them?
Oh yeah, totally. They're really nice with a quick pickle.
Yeah.
So equal parts vinegar and water and a little salt and a little sugar. Heat that up so you dissolve the salt and the sugar, and then pour those right over the ramp bulbs. The leaves don't pickle as well, but the bulbs pickle really well. There used to be a bar that I used to go to when I visited friends in New York, and they would serve a martini with a pickled ramp bulb, which was really very classy.
Nice.
So that's a fun thing to do too.
Yeah. What
ramps
was your tip?
Transplantable. So if you find ramps at the farmer's market or in the woods and you use them, you can always replant the stem. So if it has roots on it, throw those in the ground, cover it up. They sort of like a rocky hillside, if you can find that, and check again next year, and they will have popped up if they like the conditions that you put them in. So that's a really fun way to, you know, if you live near woods, spread the ramp population so that we can keep enjoying them.
Nice. Well, I want to ask you about fava beans, because you have a very cool recipe for fava beans, and I feel like these are underappreciated. I don't feel like they're very widely known or used.
Outside of Italy, you don't see them a lot. Italy and California, I guess.
Yeah, but they're delicious.
They're so good. Oh my God. They're so good. And the coolest thing about fava beans is that you can eat the entire plant. So fava beans grow and you can eat their leaves. You can saute their leaves with a little butter, throw in a dash of soy sauce at the end. And it's just like, it's so delicious. You can also eat, of course, you can eat the bean, right?
Yep.
You can eat the skin that's around the bean. And then a lot of people don't know this. You can eat the pod. And so fava beans come in this like 6 to 8 inch sort of like spongy pod. And most people just throw that out. They peel the bean, then they blanch the bean and they just serve the bean. But those pods are really fun in like a tempura batter fry. And so make a little tempura batter with some like a loose batter with either you can use beer as your liquid or seltzer water. Dip your fava pod in there and then deep fry it. And it will become super crunchy and super soft on the inside. And I just like, fry them and dip them in mayonnaise or ketchup and just eat them like French fries. So it's a really fun plant. I grow them here. It's the first thing I plant in the spring. I plant them mid-March because they're frost tolerant and they do not like the heat. So mine grew about 8 inches this week because of the heat. So I'm hoping it cools down a little bit.
So like you would peas.
Exactly. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. And where do you recommend folks find them if they're looking for some, looking to try some?
I would think a high-end grocery store that has a good produce section would carry them this time of year. You can always find a good grocery store and ask the produce manager. If they get enough requests for them, they can order them in.
Yeah. Well, and I would be remiss if I did not ask you for your favorite recipe for rhubarb.
Rhubarb favorite recipe. Well, that's tough.
Well, I hear that you have a good one for drinking it. Is this
true? So I love a rhubarb Collins. You make a simple syrup, so equal parts sugar and water, and then blanch a couple stalks of rhubarb in that simple syrup. Blend it and strain it. And then what you have, of course, is you have a rhubarb simple syrup. And with that, you can add some lemon juice, a little gin, top it off with some soda water, serve it on the rocks. It's such a refreshing and also beautiful little cocktail. I mean, you don't have to put the gin in it, but, you should.
Well, why not?
So it's such a pretty color that it feels really classy just because of the color. That the red of the rhubarb translates into this like really pretty pink in that cocktail.
And it's got vitamin C, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's a healthy one. Why not?
Well, Ian, what spring vegetable do you think is often underrated or overlooked?
Oh, dandelion.
Really?
Because it's everywhere, first of all. And it's delicious in lots of different forms. I do two main things with the dandelion that I find. I take the greens and I make a hot dressing. So I cook some bacon and I save the bacon fat. And then I whisk together an egg and some water and a little vinegar and a little sugar. And then I cook that in very slowly in the bacon fat until it congeals and gets a little thick. And then I toss that hot dressing with the dandelion and it just ever so slightly wilts the dandelion, and the sweetness and the richness of the dressing help balance the bitterness. This was actually my grandmother's recipe. And then of course you take the bacon that you cooked and you sprinkle it over top. The other thing that I like to do with them is I like to make capers. So you're familiar with capers, of course, the Italian little flower bud that's brined and pickled. Just before the dandelions pop up, I go outside and I pick the buds. It takes forever because they're so tiny. And then I take them home, wash them. I put them in a salt brine for about a week. They lacto ferment. That means that they start to get a little sour and they absorb some of that salt. And they themselves are very bitter. And so you're starting to see some balance here. Then I take them out of that brine and I put them in a vinegar mixture and I just keep them in my fridge and use them just like capers. Anytime.
Thank you, Ian. We are out of time. I could talk with you all day.
Oh, me too.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, this has been so fun. Thank you.
That was Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer, author of The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. We've been talking about in-season produce. Happy Friday, everyone. Friday the 13th, that is. Nearly one in five Americans believe that the date Friday the 13th brings bad luck. That's according to the online polling service YouGov. Another 15% said they weren't quite sure. So what's with this frigga triska decaphobia? Yeah, that's the term for fear of Friday the 13th. Well, one theory dates back to biblical stories. You know, the Last Supper, Christ plus 12, disciples equals 13. This gave rise to the superstition that 13 guests seated around a table courted death. Others point to the novel Friday the 13th, written in 1907 by Thomas Lawson, which told the story of a New York City stockbroker who plays on superstitions about the date to create chaos on Wall Street. What's a superstition you believe in to this day? Let us know. Ideas at WPR.org. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.